Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Last Sunday night on ESPN, the network aired parts 1 and 2 of the 10-part series, The Last Dance, which chronicles the final season of the Chicago Bulls dynasty that won 6 championships in 8 seasons. This week on the Mike Wise Show, our guest is a close friend of Phil Jackson, who coached the Bulls to all 6 NBA titles and 5 more with the Lakers. And he's ready to check in. But first, Darlene, do your thing.
The Mike Wise Show is a presentation of Pure Hoops Media. The Mike Wise Show is hosted by a guy who played basketball atrociously for Hawaii Pacific College, which forced him into journalism. And, oh yeah, he wrote about basketball for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and ESPN. He's also a wise ass, and so are many of his guests. Right, Mike?
That's right, Darlene. I'm really excited about this week. Look, we've had an unbelievable 3 weeks, I got to admit. Mark Cuban, Jamal Crawford, last week Roger Mason Jr., and this week we go old school. I mean, really old school. Charlie Rosen is an author and former basketball coach who was Phil Jackson's assistant with the old CBA's Albany Patroons from 1983 to 86. Their relationship started in the mid-1970s when they collaborated on a book together for the first time. Charlie, on his own, has written 16 books, including many on the sport of basketball. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, 25 books, actually.
25?
Yeah.
This is why I tell my crack shot researchers to stop looking at Wikipedia. This is, it's 9 books behind the times. Just curious, what was your last?
It's called Truth, Lies, and Basketball. It's a novel about, and it's all based on fact, about all the crooked, illegal things that are done in college ball and in the NBA. It is fiction, but everything in the book happened, including a major D1 basketball program recruiting a player who was a heroin addict and supplying his dope.
And nobody sued you?
Well, I changed the names to protect the guilty.
To protect the guilty, right. And people who, I know you and I've known you for 25, 30 years, because even when I was covering the Knicks back in the 90s for the New York Times, you were the Phil whisperer. You know, everybody would go, "Hey, what's going on with Phil?" And people would call Charlie Rosen because, you know, they go back to Woodstock and, you know, all these days. And you would have all these incredible, you would sort of say, you know, "Well, Phil's thinking about this, Phil said," and most of the time you're always right. I know all this, but I think that people that are listening to the podcast for either the first time or the 64th time, and they don't know who Charlie Rosen is, I'm going to let you know right away. Tell people how your relationship with Phil started.
Well, I used to hang out with Stan Love. I hooked up with Stan Love. Remember him?
Yes.
And he was coming into the Garden, and I lived in New York at the time. And he said he had been invited to a party at Phil Jackson's place, which was a loft on West 19th Street, which is over a car repair place. So I went there, Stan split, hung out, had a great time. And I was doing a story, I think, for Sport magazine on like the hippie guys or something in the NBA. I did Stan and Billy Pauls, and I asked Phil if he'd willing to be interviewed. So he said yes. So the day that I was supposed to come down there and interview him, my ex-wife shows up in New York. And she's like writing poetry and she's all excited. She's going to get her poetry published. And I had to kind of babysit her. So she had to come down there to Phil's place. And I was like, really embarrassing. But Phil's future wife, June, just took care of her. And I did the interview. And after the season, Phil had this pickup game with a whole bunch of his friends at the UN's gym, someplace in the '50s.
The United Nations gym.
Yes.
That's
and
tremendous.
They needed a big guy for Phil to beat up. So I'm 6'8", and I was chosen, and that was the beginning of it.
A long relationship.
Yeah,
that's great. I have a friend. I don't know if you know him. He works for the Wizards, Dolph. Dolph's been around forever, and he's one of these guys that he remembers Phil from the old days back in the 60s. This apartment, like, they would basically roll up the rug. They, you know, the joints would start passing around. The music would be going. This was a full-on party.
Well, there were no drugs in that party that I went to. But there was a picture of Agnew. Remember Agnew, the vice president?
Yeah, Spiro
and
Agnew.
Darts. Right, and darts. And people would throw darts at the
at him. Nixon's VP? But,
yes.
I love it.
What impressed me about Phil was he was – I had done many, many stories on NBA stars, and it was always that NBA attitude. But he was like a regular guy, and his friends, the people there, were like regular people. And that was really unusual and very interesting to me.
Yeah. I love that Stan Love, the father of Kevin Love, actually got you guys introduced in a weird way. You played college ball. Tell people where you played.
I played at Hunter College, which is now Lehman College in the Bronx. And
yeah.
I had a pretty good career.
From what I remember, even back in the day in the 90s, you were still playing pickup ball.
Oh, I played pickup ball till I was in my mid-50s. I played in prisons. I played in the World Senior Games when I was like 53 or something. I had a hip replacement, and that was at the end. Actually, the day I stopped, I think I was 55, and I was playing at the Y, pickup game at the Y in Kingston, New York, which is around here. And there was a loose ball. There was this young guy, 6'4", maybe 220, 230, and the two of us were going after the ball. And I went to one of my old tricks. I hit him in the chest with an elbow to slow him up, and it just bounced right off of him. And the next morning, my elbow like swelled up, and I said, that's the end.
I think we all have those moments. Mine are my knees. Anybody who's an old pickup player, you once one part of your body goes, and you know, as anybody, it doesn't matter whether you get on a treadmill, you walk five times a day, there's nothing like pickup basketball. I mean, there's Bill Bradley's quote about it, I thought said the best. He goes, I can play 3-on-3 with a guy for 10 minutes, and I could tell you more about him as a person and who he is more than I could sitting next to him in a cubicle for a year at work.
Absolutely. And when I was coaching, it was the same thing. You watch a guy play, you could tell
who he is. Right.
Yeah. Bradley once hit me in the back with a pass at the 92nd Street Y. That's one of my claims to fame.
So one of the reasons I brought you on as well, not only do you have these old great stories and you know, the ESPN is moving up the release of The Last Dance. It chronicles the final season of the Bulls dynasty. Plenty of drama And, you know, I look back on it and I covered it for the New York Times, and I covered it and I was part of a lot of it. But, you know, you don't see all the stuff behind the scenes. Michael Jordan says he's worried people aren't going to think he was a great teammate when everybody watches this, because it's pretty unfiltered. You knew all these stories about Michael, and he was, you know, it's sort of like ends just, you know, the means justify the end. They won a championship. When you're punching Steve in the face and you're winning titles, you're just a competitor. When you're 38 and 45 with the Wizards at the end of your career, and you're, you know, and you're telling Kwame Brown he's the worst piece of turd you ever seen play, then you're just an old guy that doesn't get it and doesn't know how to nurture young players. I'm of the opinion that Michael, you know, anybody could get away with whatever Michael did as a competitor, or whatever, because he won games and he did it the way Michael does it. What your thoughts?
Well, guys on the team were afraid of Michael, because if they made a mistake, he'd be screaming at him and yelling at him. And Pippen was the guy they would go to kind of calm them down and talk some sense into them. But I witnessed the best shot that anybody ever made, the best shot in the history of basketball. It was done by Michael Jordan. It was, I forgot the year. I was coaching the Rockford Lightning in the CBA, which is like 70 miles from Chicago. So I had dibs on all the guys that the Bulls drafted and didn't make the team. And I think there were 5 or 6 or 7 draft choices back in the day. So it's the first day of practice, and it's a closed gym, but I was in there because of and Phil was an assistant, my affiliation with Phil and with the Lightning. So they're scrimmaging, and it's the first day, and the rookies are going crazy, diving all over the place, and the veterans are running wide circles around the rookies. They don't want to get involved in anything. So Michael steals the ball, and he comes running down ahead of the court, and there's a guy named Matt Brust from St. John's, who was the 5th round draft choice of the Bulls. Oh, 6'4", 6'5", white guy, big shoulders, good 3-point shooter, had reputation as being a tough, 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 tough guy. So Michael dribbles down, goes up for the layup, Brust smashes him from behind, knocks him on the floor, and it's like, uh-oh, Jerry Krause dropped his donut. That's how serious it looked. So
Jerry dropped his donut. That's like Warren Buffett dropping his wallet.
Right. So Michael gets up. Yeah, I'm okay. All right. So they keep on playing. Several minutes later, Michael steals the ball again. And here he comes, ahead of the field, and here comes Brust. But this time he knows Brust is coming. So you got to picture this. Michael takes off, palming the ball in his right hand on the right side of the basket. He goes up. He's in the air. Here comes Brust. With his left arm, Michael smashes Brust in the face with his elbow. He's still up in the air. Switches the ball to his left hand. His left hand goes underneath and around the basket and dunks.
Oh,
best shot I have ever seen. Michael was such a competitor, and one of the reasons why he got along so well with Phil, number one, Phil wasn't intimidated by superstars. You know, he played with Clyde and the captain and everybody. Right. When the Knicks really put the NBA on the national map as far as, you know, sports was concerned, when they won those championships. And the other reason is that the two of them, Phil and Michael, were the fiercest competitors in the whole Bulls organization. I mean, I've played piddlywinks with Phil just for laughs, and he freaked out when he lost. He was just in anything. And so that's why they got along. I remember one incident. Again, it was close to the media. It was a practice, and the Bulls are scrimmaging, and it's Pippen's team against Michael's team, and they're playing like it's the seventh game of the championship, right?
That's
and it
great.
Comes down to, and Pippen's team wins basket game over, celebrating. Michael comes storming off the court. He's like, you know, boiling. That's when they let the media in. And the media is all smiles. Hey, Michael, what's it? And he starts screaming and cursing at them.
At the media.
At the media.
That's great.
And they had no idea what was going on. He lost a practice game. And among the many reasons why Collins got fired was that Michael used to ruin all the drills. Whatever drill you ran, he'd just overpower whatever was going on. And in order to make the scrimmages competitive, Collins used to cheat on the score. So Michael's team wouldn't be that far ahead. That was one thing that Michael just could not deal with.
Charlie Rosen is now 79 years old. He's done it and seen it all, and he's giving us some great insight into the Bulls organization that he knew through Phil Jackson and his own observations. I still remember Jerry Sloan, Charlie, telling me once, it was after the first Bulls championship over the Jazz. He said, you know, when I know when Michael was the most son of a bitch, I'll beat your ass competitor I'd ever seen. And I go, no, when? And he goes, didn't have anything to do with the steal, the shot, all that, anything you'd done. He had gotten stripped on one end by John Stockton, went to the ground. Stockton went all the way back the other end, and he basically got up and caught him and somehow raced down the court to swat the shot away. And he said, never seen a guy who wanted to win as much as I did until that moment. And I think it says, you know, he was the ultimate competitor. We saw it come out in his Hall of Fame speech, whether you liked it or didn't like it. That's who he was. And I love the contrast to Phil, because people remember, people think of Phil as sort of not the anti-Pat Riley, but the sort of you know, if Riley was refined and understood the things that could be gained from a Sundance or a sweat lodge or a sage smudging, all these things that Phil learned and incorporated into his coaching, at his heart, he wanted to get your ass.
You know, we played when I was his assistant for 3 years. We travel around the league and do this and play one-on-one all the time, full court, but it had to be a small court. And, you know, I was 6'8". In college, I could catch and shoot, but the only time I could put the ball on the floor with any success was with my back to the basket. So we played full court. If he guarded me full court, he'd just take the ball away from me. But we play and we play and we play, and must have played over the 3 years, 150 games. And I beat him once.
Wow.
Hitting shots, whatever.
You guys were going hard. He was not.
Oh, we're going hard. Yeah. But he let me do things on defense. He kind of let me bring the ball up. And some of the times he let me go left, which I wasn't very good at. So I'm ahead by a point. You have to win by two, right?
Mm.
And he comes dribbling down the court, and I know he's going to score. And if he scores, he's going to win, because he's going to full court press me, and that'll be the end. So he's dribbling down. He's near the sideline, and bam, I hit him with a block like a middle linebacker. You smash him to the floor, grab the ball, dribble down, score. I win. He said, you fouled me. I said, of course I fouled you. How else am I going to beat you? He said, did you ever lose a game in the NBA where a foul wasn't called? And we were like buddies. You know, we used to room together on the road. We just, he stalked off. He went to a private gym and he meditated for about an hour and wouldn't speak to me. So my record against him was like, you know, 1-149.
I love, that's great. When was the last time you spoke to Phil?
Spoke to him while we email, you know.
Okay.
Probably the last time I spoke to him when he was in New York.
Yeah, I mean, when was the last time you emailed?
Oh, a week, 2 weeks ago, maybe. Yeah. He's in Montana now. He said he got off the plane, and there were state troopers there. And they escorted everybody, and he had to be quarantined at his
because
place.
Of the COVID? Because he traveled?
Because of the COVID, yes, he had to travel.
Where did he come from? Where was he?
L.A. He had to get out of L.A.
Is he still seeing Jeannie?
No.
That's been over for a while.
It's been over for a long time.
Yeah. Yes. No, the reason I ask is because Jeannie's been texting me, wants to get something going, and I refuse to. I'm married. I'm happy. And, you know, I don't want to go there, Charlie. I do not need to get involved with an NBA owner right now in my life.
Right. She
and then my alarm rang. Yeah, okay.
She was one of the many people, including me, who told Phil, don't go back to New York.
Oh, she did. She told him not to go back to New York. Yeah, so this is one of my things. I haven't talked to Phil in forever. And even when I think he liked me more when I was with the New York Times, because I could give him a more high publicized forum. But I always had a great relationship with him. And he was always honest with me. If he didn't want to tell me something, he said, I can't tell you that. But I really wanted him to see him do well in New York. And, you know, was he going to get them to a title? No. But I still look at the Knicks as, it's almost like, you know, I call it the Washington football team here in D.C. It's like the Knicks are the reverse car wash. You go in clean and you leave filthy. And it's because of Dolan. And I don't, you know, but I want to know your feelings, because you remember those great Knicks teams. You remember those Knicks days. It must have bugged you to your core how Phil went from this possible savior to this guy that you know, he didn't know what he was doing in New York, whom he was portrayed as.
Well, he knew what he was doing. They kind of stabbed him in the back. A lot of people like Miller, they just stabbed him in the back. So
he got his, by the way.
Yes, he did. So, I mean, take Porzingis. Okay, he drafted Porzingis. Gaines, Clarence Gaines, Little House said, you know, draft. We drafted him, and it's amazing potential there. But then Phil saw the way the league played him. Porzingis had no lower body strength. His footwork was not good at all. His balance was bad. And the second time around the league, everybody started putting stronger guys to guard him when he posted up, because their center of gravity was lower, so they could push him and push him, which put a lot of strain on his legs and his lower back. And Phil wanted to trade him, right, after that first year, second year. He would have gotten a load back. He would have gotten starters. He would have gotten everything back. And they just said, no, you can't. He's the franchise. So then they traded him for nothing. You know, but the other thing that worked against him, one of the reasons that Phil re-signed Carmelo Anthony is Dolan really wanted him. But also, if they would have played the triangle, Carmelo would have gotten the ball on the weak side elbow. A guard would have then cut to the basket, and he would have been like 16, 17-foot jump shot, one or two dribbles from the basket. The defense would be too far away to come double him. He would have been a monster. But in order to get there, he'd have to catch the ball and pass it and make a cut and do this and that, which Melo didn't want to do. He wanted to catch the ball and shoot it. So
that's what I was going to say. Could players with lesser hoop IQs handle the triangle.
Oh, yeah. You know, so and I think it was Carmelo who ruined Porzingis. Porzingis came out in the media and said, "Oh, I love the triangle." And Melo told him, "Don't you ever say anything positive about the triangle in the media again."
Did he really?
And oh yeah, and he kind of ruined the kid. Where
did Phil find out? Did Phil find out about that? That he told him that?
Oh yeah, you know what can you do? You can't go into the locker room.
Yeah.
And you know, you're an outsider.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, you're an outsider. And it got to the point when Porzingis was a rookie, he was kind of humble and learning and figuring things out. I had a couple of conversations with him. He was, you know, open and this and that. But by the time Melo got a hold of him, he cursed once Jeff Hornacek, who's a nice guy, who's too nice. That was his problem. He was too soft with these players. He was a little too intimidated by coming to New York and coaching these guys. But he cursed out Hornacek, which is something you don't do. The guy had been in the league for a million years. He'd been an all-star. You know, you show the guy some respect. So, you know, that's what happened. And I'm sure Isaiah was still buzzing in Dolan's ear.
You think so? He still had his ear and he was sort of like, what are you doing? And I don't know, the whole thing. The whole thing left a sour taste on my mouth. You think Phil will ever come back to the game in any way?
No.
That's it. He's done.
I mean, like, you know, people think that I just parrot Phil's what he believes.
Yeah.
That's not the case. It so happens on a lot of areas we both think the same way. We've had a lot of disagreements on players, you know, guys I thought he should have, even in the CBA, signed this guy and not that guy and do this and not that. But I have a negative view of the NBA these days, and Phil is kind of tending toward that. It's, I mean, you remember the old game, and this new game is like a made-for-TV spectacle.
Yeah, it's fun. I really enjoy watching like Steph Curry and a team like that, and I think he's in some ways because he shoots from the parking lot and he's so good that. Everybody wants to do that now. It's depressing to me that, I don't know, I'm only 6'5", but growing up in Hawaii, I was sort of a big guy. You know, I was like 7 foot in Hawaii. And so, a high school player. And then, I didn't even, when I got to college, I could barely handle the ball because they wanted me to be a center. But I love the inside-outside game. And I love the, you know, the triangle. I love moving. The sublime choreography of teamwork that was basketball is turned into, you're right, a video game in some ways. And there's a few teams that pass well and do all the right things, and then others try to do it, and it just, it's a mess. It's the Houston Rockets most nights.
Right, right. And I would love to see how Curry would have done with Scottie Pippen's elbow in his chest all the time.
Well, okay. I'm with you on that.
Anymore.
No, I know what you're saying. Like, guys, no, you right. The physical nature of the games. I mean,
hands off defense.
Oh yeah, no, you're right. It's you know what did Chick Hearn used to say? No harm, no foul, no ambulance. Oh yeah, there's a harm if you breathe on a guy now.
Right,
but you're right. No, it's a different game. It's it's a game that they want to maximize scoring. They want to maximize their offensive weapons. I get it, but you're right. You don't have the hard fouls anymore. You know, there's no message sending anymore. It's just sort of how can you hold the guy down from 50? Does Phil? He's in Montana. Does he have any plans? Does he have any plans to do anything? You want to collaborate with one more book with him? Maybe.
Well, we talked about it, but I don't think he wants to talk, because then he has to talk about the Knicks and everything. I don't think he wants to go public with a lot of that stuff.
I think he should. Well, you know, like what's wrong with it? I mean, well, I guess he would look as a sour grapes kind of guy. He got his money, and he's just trash. But I don't think, I mean, bottom line is, you know, it's the common denominator. You know, James Dolan's the common denominator. Whatever toxic top-down culture started there, it's affected a lot of people negatively, and he happens to be the common denominator, not Phil. And so that would be my thing. And I think that, you know, shoot, anybody that wants to see that franchise win something big again would actually probably like the transparency and the honesty. But I get it. Phil doesn't want to come across as sour grapes. He's in Montana. You got to get me to his Montana place to go fishing. I love trout fishing.
Oh, what a place. It's amazing. He's got 13 grandchildren and 5 children. So, it's like an estate. And it's right on this big huge lake. And he's got enough houses there for everybody. Oh. And it's amazing. There are eagles flying all over the place. It's so beautiful. It is such an amazing place.
Yeah, maybe I need to do one of those sport magazine stories, but like for a magazine that still exists now. Sir, does Phil think Michael's hiatus ever had anything to do with gambling?
He gambled and he lost a lot of money and he paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, I think that thing about, you know, killing his father and something, that was nonsense.
No, I don't believe that had anything to do with his father.
I don't believe it. And, you know, he gambled late and then he came and played. It didn't matter. He was
a special individual.
Yeah, he come off his deathbed, you know, and still play hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I always wondered if that got them into trouble. But either way, he came back. You know, if Krause hadn't said that Phil was gone after 98, and that was obviously the last dance of the Bulls, would Michael have stayed on and kept playing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And
really?
Of course. They would have won at least 2 more championships.
Really? So you think, you think Michael got out because Phil essentially was, you know, persona non grata at that point with Jerry, and they were going to, Reinsdorf was all behind, you know, moving on and didn't want to play.
Right.
That's crazy. So they could have won at least a couple more. You're right.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and Phil, he deserves more credit than he gets. When he was an assistant, he was behind trading Cartwright for Oakley. And and here's the reason why. The two of us, when we were with the Patroons, we had this relationship with the Knicks. You know, we get the extra players. So we go down to, I think they were at Hofstra, and it's their first practice session. UB Brown was the coach. And
if you are in the painted area and you want the ball and you can't get it, you are fucked. I love Pubie. I think he's the best.
Yeah, Pubie. Oh, I got Pubie stories too, but that takes too long. So we're down there, and Ewing is a rookie. Cartwright said Ewing is going to take his job, right? So the scrimmaging, they scrimmage for about a half an hour, at least 10, 12 times, Cartwright knocked Ewing on his ass.
Wow.
Bang. Take that, rookie. Bang. Take that. Bang. And you could see Ewing was intimidated. And it's like if you put a yellow ribbon around a baby elephant's nose and you do things, he grows up, you know, still the same fears and the same reactions. So Phil knew that Cartwright could control Ewing. And he was the one behind the trade. And Oakley, Oakley was great. Oakley was great, but he wouldn't hit a shot for you in the last 5 minutes of a game.
Yeah, I love Charles Oakley. I'll defend him too, but more along the lines of he was a great role player. And you're probably right. He shouldn't have been taking the shot in the last 5 minutes of a game.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's a reason why he took the shot, because they let him take it.
Yeah, right. You know, Charles and Michael. Charles Oakley and Michael were close too. I think that You know, he,
Cartwright did something else. Michael wouldn't pass Cartwright the ball because Cartwright wasn't a great passer. And, you know, sometime in his career, Cartwright got hit in the larynx. And he kind of talked like this. You know, he had this high-pitched voice. And there's this guy, you know, 6'10", what did he weigh, 280? Talking like
this. Yeah, it's huge.
So he was a really sweet guy. So Michael wouldn't pass him the ball. And at one point, Cartwright went over to him and says, "If you don't pass me the ball, I'm going to just kick your ass, period." And that was it. And Michael
That's a very good Cartwright. I worked in Sacramento for many years. He's from Elk Grove High School. That's a great Cartwright.
Oh, he's a great guy. And the triangle offense operated a little more efficiently then.
Right. Yeah. I look back on all this and I look, you know, I remember Michael said he'd never play for another coach. Of course he did with Doug Collins in Washington. Right. And I always wonder if he, you know, did he think people would forget what he said? But I also think Michael was, you know, he wanted to scratch that itch again.
That's it. Exactly. Exactly.
And he didn't really, I look back at Rodman too, you know, in some ways I feel sorry for him because he's just such a, you could tell he's hurting inside by a lot of things, but you know, he was just a handful. But the one thing I look about Phil, you know, is,
well, I got a Rodman story.
Oh, you got to go for it. Go for it. I love Rodman. He's just a character.
I love Rodman. We were going to do a book together. He's intelligent. And he did many books. That was the problem. There were too many books. And no publishers were interested in it. But he had all kinds of stuff to say about North Korea, you know, and this and that.
Right, right.
So this is after his career. Rodman's career.
Okay.
In the NBA. And occasionally he'd do a guest appearance at an old ABA game or a CBA game and, you know, get a lot of money and attract fans and things like that. So I think it was the CBA. He comes into the game and Scotty Wedman was coaching the other team. I did a lot of clinics with Scotty. So he comes into the game, Rodman, he's on defense. And the guy he's guarding goes into the low post. And they're kind of jockeying for position. The guy doesn't have the ball yet. All of a sudden, the offensive guy, the pivot guy, Rodman is guarding, does like a 10-foot broad jump. So they come into the huddle, and Scotty says, What the hell was that? What was that? The guy said, "Rodman stuck a finger up my butt."
Oh, that's hilarious.
It's called down and dirty defense, I guess.
You got to finish the story about Bill threatening to kick his ass. Did we already do that?
Yeah. Oh, Bill. No, it was Bill who said that, not Phil. No.
That's what I said. Bill, MJ's. Yeah, Bill was going to kick MJ's ass.
And then MJ backed off and started passing him the ball.
That's great.
You know, Cartwright was the kind of guy, if you walked down the street next to him, you had to be about 2 feet away because his elbows would be flying all over the place, and he'd just knock you down. That's just the way you walked, you know. But such a nice guy, such a wonderful guy.
The last couple, I still look at one of the things I think of as a great coach, great teammate, what a great player is. I call it the knucklehead quotient. If you're really a great coach, you can get people that are perceived malcontents and get them into buying in, or at least, you know, whether they're on the bench or a role player like Rodman. You know, I look at all the guys that people, you know, they just gave them fits everywhere they went. And yet, like a guy like, you know, people don't remember Isaiah Ryder, J.R. Ryder got a freaking ring with the Lakers. You know, met a world peace, got a ring on a Phil team. Ron Artest, when he was Ron Artest, he was, you know, he was unreliable. You never knew what he was going to do. Dennis Rodman. I mean, Bison Dele, the late Bison Dele, Brian Williams, got a ring with Phil Jackson. I look at a lot of that ability to get those kind of players to conform to your system, or you know, at least within their own individual means. I think a lot of that is Phil. I think basically it's a lot of who you and Phil were growing up as these real accepting guys out of the 60s and 70s that weren't from the hard-ass school of the Krzyzewskis and the Bobby Knights. It's like, yeah, there's some players you could put up against a locker, and that's what you needed to do. But there were other guys that you didn't need to kick them in the ass like that. You needed to motivate them other ways. You needed to give them books. You needed to give them, you know. Well, I think that's one of the great testaments to his coaching.
Well, you know, Rodman learned the triangle in about 3 days. And it took guys like Peyton and Malone, who never learned it, who didn't want to learn it. So yeah. Rodman just slid right in. Artest, the first year Artest was there, he bought into the triangle and really worked it. But then after that, the year after that, he said, okay, I got my ring. Now I can go back and do what I want. And that was one of the reasons why that team broke up.
Oh, interesting.
Why that team wasn't successful.
The Last Dance coming up, by the way. I'm sure that, you know, you were part of that season as well. I look back at just the start of things. When, you know, you're telling me all this stuff about how your relationship started with Phil. What did you take from, you know, when you were his assistant with the Albany Patroons, when he was developing his coaching philosophy back in that day, what were some of his principles? And obviously he took them to the next level.
Well, he was looking for an offense. We used the flex in those days, which gets everybody involved and everybody has to do everything. But there are only 2 points of initiation. So, you know, you could kind of stop it. So he's looking for that. But he...
That was the old Bobby Knight offense with Indiana in the old days.
No. That was USC when Tex was there, when Bill Sharman was there. It has a long history. It's nothing to do with Bobby Knight.
But Indiana, that 76 team played the flex. Did he just steal it from
them? No, they didn't.
They didn't. What did they play?
I don't remember. I could tell you a story.
You don't know anything. You don't know anything, Charlie. You're only 79. Damn it. Go ahead.
I'll tell you a story about me and Phil and Bobby Knight.
No, go. Yeah, go ahead. I love all these digressions. All
right, okay. So we're both in Albany, and Bobby Knight is doing some kind of clinic, maybe down in Poughkeepsie. I don't remember. So we were interested to find out some of Bobby Knight's game plan, like his press or something like that, okay? So we go down to Poughkeepsie, and it's in a gym, and there are a whole bunch of guys there, assistant coaches, you know, wearing the knit shirts with the emblem of their school. And Bobby Knight gets up there, and he starts talking about drugs. And if it was up to him, he'd bomb the drug fields in Colombia and make the whole country a parking lot and this and that and the other thing. And he didn't say anything about basketball.
And the whole time
we're sitting there, we have notebooks, there's nothing. So we break for lunch. So everybody leaves. And it's on a basketball court, right? And there's a basketball there. So we take our shirts off and play one-on-one during the lunch hour.
You, Phil, and Bobby, who? And Bobby Knight?
Me and Phil. Me
oh,
and
you, Phil. Okay.
And nobody else is here. Bobby Knight comes walking back in. We put the ball down, put our shirts on, and walked out.
That's awesome. Bobby Knight was the anti, I mean, shoot, he was the anti Woodstock guy. He was the, were you at Woodstock?
No. And you know what they say around Woodstock? They say, if you remember being at Woodstock, you weren't there.
That's true. Yeah. And
because you were too stoned to remember you were there.
What was the most serious drugs you took in the 60s? LSD?
Oh, yeah.
What else?
Mushrooms, you know, smoked pot. I never did any, you know, heroin, anything like that. But I did, I did a lot of drugs. I taught at a community college. And they were different days. I go to concerts, dead concerts with some of my students. They'd give me drugs. I never fooled around with them, but, you know, as far as anything else. But that was what you did. In those days, it was like a strike against the empire to do that kind of stuff.
How, what are the most serious drugs you've done with Phil?
You know, we smoked pot once or twice.
That's it.
That's it. That's it. Oh, that's
I wanted. I wanted some. I wanted some big acid trip story.
None. Well, there's an acid trip that he took that we write about in the first book we did, Maverick. He's on a beach in L.A. and he took acid, and he felt like a lion. And he was kind of roaring up and down the beach. And this is when he was an assistant with the Bulls. I don't remember when the book came out. And Jerry Krause was so freaked out that he bought up as many of the copies of that book as possible, so no one else could read it.
So when no one else could see it. Let's really quick. Let's go back to the Bulls. I think that Krause and I was trying to be congenial with everyone at the time. And in some ways, you know, they used to call him Crumbs. That was their nickname for him because he was, he was a little obese and he was an old-time baseball scout in the Bill Veeck days. I know he was the anti-Phil type of guy, but it seemed like that worked for a long time. He was a polarizing figure. You know, the players and Phil all seemingly loathed him. Was the mutual dislike of Krause something that united the players and Phil looking back?
I think so. Sometimes he used to go on a plane with them, and they just would insult him and curse him, and he kind of stopped. He stopped doing that. He had no people. He couldn't relate to people. I had some dealings with him. I was in the middle of the Bulls when they signed Cliff Levingston. I was coaching in Savannah, and I was in between Krause. Says this, which I would then tell Livingston's agent and that kind of stuff. I had some dealings with him. I have another story. I don't know how much time you have.
No, I like for you, just keep going. I love this stuff.
So Phil, when I was coaching in Rockford and they fired Johnny Bock, which is a whole other story, an item appeared in the Chicago Tribune. It was in the middle of the season that I was going to replace Johnny Bock. Now, Phil and I always had the understanding once he got to be the head coach, yes, I know he could do what he wants. I didn't expect to be called up or anything like that. Although he did try to bring me up as an assistant with the Bulls, but Krause said no. Krause wanted all the assistants to be beholden to Krause.
When was that?
Oh, in the late 80s, maybe. Like that. And Phil, in a lot of ways, doesn't like confrontations. Okay. So Krause called me up and said, and this is the guy that Phil and I used to belittle, and, you know, along with a lot of other people. And Krause says, Charlie, we can't hire you as an assistant coach. We have to hire an NBA veteran, somebody who played in the NBA. That's the only kind of assistant coach that the players will respect. Okay, fine. You know, I could deal with it. But what pissed me off, and then they hired Jimmy Rogers, who's a great assistant and a wonderful man. I did a profile on him. And was an assistant coach when Phil was in college to Bill Fitch. But, one of the best assistant coaches ever. Okay, so that was a little bit of a lie, but I understand it. But what pissed me off is that Phil didn't call and tell me. He had Kraus tell me.
Phil didn't want to deal with pissing off his good friend, and he had Kraus do it instead of dealing with conflict right up front.
We didn't speak to each other for about 2 years, maybe, until a player who was Phil's roommate with the Knicks for 2 years was a buddy of mine, Eddie Mast, used to come to games when we played Lancaster. He lived in Easton, PA. He used to come and hang around with us, as long as we were there. We did clinics with Eddie. I traveled with Eddie to do clinics in Boston. I'd visit with him. He'd come up in Woodstock and spend a week. We were like the Three Musketeers for several years. And so Eddie died. So at the funeral, that's the first time we hadn't spoken to each other, and we were both pallbearers. And we kind of looked at each other, and there's Eddie in the coffin, and we said, okay, enough of this. And we renewed our friendship, I think, on a deeper level.
Oh, that's you finally put your bothers, what bothered you aside, and he put that's funny you say that about Phil, because I've never had that kind of relationship with him, but there's been times when I've written things and all of a sudden he just changes. You know, and it's sort of like, well, Phil, I had to be critical here. And, but that's just who he is, it's interesting because he's had that with his players too. You know, Kobe doesn't really find out how Phil feels about him until he writes a book about him. And even though he tells him, I always wonder Michael Phil relationship. Obviously they bonded over the competitiveness. You know, I always wonder if Phil, like those 2 years, they could have won those years. I still don't believe Michael Jordan just left basketball because he wanted to spend more time and play baseball with his family. I'm not going to believe it. I'm sorry.
Well, this is what I think really happened, okay?
Yeah.
Kraus was a big fan of Kukoc.
Yep.
And he'd go in disguise in Europe and watch him play and said publicly that he's better than Michael Jordan and they can win with Kukoc. I think Michael was really upset with that. And if you remember the first time Pippen and Jordan played Croatia in the Olympics, they buried Kukoc. They really went out of their way.
They made it a personal thing. Yeah.
They absolutely buried him. So that was, okay, you think you can do it? Do it. And Michael, from what I heard, if he had progressed, he would have been a great defensive outfielder. He would have hit like 260, 265, hit 25 home runs.
Well, that's a great
– here's a Kukoc story. So they're playing Miami in the playoffs. Phil would show his scouting movies, and he'd fill them with all kinds of crazy things to make them laugh. He once had a picture of I always forget his name. He used to be the general manager of Utah, big, heavy guy, Frank.
Frank Layden.
So, they're doing this, this is their offense. And all of a sudden, there's a 10-second clip of Frank Layden wearing a bikini bathing suit running down a beach. Imagine what that looked like.
So players probably fell out.
Yeah. That's one of the things about Phil. He'd do things that the players could never anticipate. So they always had to concentrate. You know, other guys, other coaches, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. They heard it before. They kind of tune out. But Phil would always come up with something a little different. So he's showing the game. Chris Gatlin, remember Chris Gatlin?
Yep, rangy guy for the Warriors. He played for a couple other teams.
And he played for Miami at this time. Right. Sprains his ankle. And the Bulls have the ball. And there's no timeout or something like that. And it's, okay. So they spread the court, and Gatlin is guarding Kukoc. So they run like a 1-4. So they're one-on-one. And Gatlin is literally hopping on one leg. So what does Kukoc do? He takes a 3-point shot. Ugh. So when it came time to show the film, the next day, he replays that one play 5, 6, 7, 8 times. Gatlin hopping, Kukoc shooting the 3-point, and the film turns to Kukoc and says, "That's why Croatia never won a war."
I think we should both fly to Montana and just stay in a cottage where the Phil's put up for us. What the hell? On that, whatever that lake is, Canavas or whatever the heck.
Flathead
Lake. Yeah. This has been great. And I really mean it. I'd love to call you up again and just talk old Hubie Brown stories and things like that, because you're a fountain of knowledge. And, I think some people forget that sometimes, and I really appreciate you joining us today.
Mike, it's my pleasure. Thank you for thinking of me.
All right, let's go. Time to stick the landing.
Thank you to Charlie Rosen, a basketball lifer and author of 25 books, not 16, for sharing his stories and time with me today. We look forward to the next 4 Sunday nights when the next 8 episodes of The Last Dance air on ESPN. Thanks also to my producer, Bruce Bernstein, and our editor, Ben Wolfen. Please check out all of our Pure Hoops Media shows, Full Court Press with Fanta and Adams, which has a new show each Tuesday, Catch and Shoot 2.0 with Otto Strong and Aaron Berlin with a new show every Wednesday, Buckets, Boards, and Blocks with Monica McNutt each Thursday, the Pure Hoops Podcast with BJ Armstrong and Eric Newman every Friday, and I'm back with the Mike Wise Show every Monday. Please keep all of the medical professionals and essential workers in your prayers as they lead the charge in the battle against the COVID-19 pandemic. Continue to keep your distance from others in public, wear your mask, wash your hands, treat everyone like a teammate, because look, we're all in this together. Till next week, peace.
The Mike Wise Show used to be called The Wise Ass Show, but it remains a presentation of Pure Hoops Media.